Welcome to Dublin City University Conflict Institute podcasts, bringing you in-depth analysis of some of the key contemporary issues in international affairs, with a focus on analysing conflict resolution, peace building, and security issues. This is Professor John Doyle, Director of the Institute, and today I'm talking with DCU colleague Dr. Donico Bacon about the recent war in Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia and Azerbaijan have been locked into a conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh for decades. The region, for those who don't know it, lies within Azerbaijan's internationally recognized border, been under control of ethnic Armenian forces backed by Armenia since the separatist war ended in 1994. Fighting erupted in late September, and the biggest escalation of the conflict in a quarter century, and several thousand have been left dead, barely covered by many Western media outlets. A Russian brokered deal signed by Putin and the presidents of Armenia and Azerbaijan obliges Armenian forces to leave areas in and around Nagorno-Karabakh. The agreement has sparked jubilation in Azerbaijan and furious protests in neighboring Armenia. In the last few days, Russia has deployed almost 2,000 forces as peacekeepers in armored vehicles in the region who remain there for at least 5 years as part of this agreement. But will it create the conditions for sustainable peace? To discuss this, I'm joined today by Dr. Donico Bacon, Associate Professor in the School of Law and Government here in Dublin City University, and someone who's been conducting field research in the region for over 20 years, has taught modules on non-recognized states and post-Soviet politics at Dublin City University, and has published extensively on the subject, including being the author of a forthcoming book, The Politics of Unrecognized States. And I thought it was interesting, given Dunica's experience in field research in the region, which is not that common for Western-based academics, to have a conversation with Dunica about this really high-profile conflict that's not well understood. Donica, to begin with, I suppose, for those who are not familiar with the basic origins of the conflict, if you could tell us a little bit about how the conflict began, its modern origins in particular, and how we've ended up in this situation.
Well, the modern origins can be traced back to the collapse and erosion of Soviet power at the end of the 1980s and beginning of the 1990s. You had enduring rivalries between Armenians and Azerbaijanis for some time before that, but they were restrained by Soviet authoritarian power. The basic ingredient of the conflict was the inclusion of Nagorno-Karabakh in Soviet Azerbaijan. It was majority Armenian, and the Armenians who were recovering from the trauma of what they consider to be a genocidal attack on their nation by the Turks during World War I, they had just really recovered from that and were kind of then included into the Soviet Union and were hoping at least that their borders would reflect their own aspirations, but they were disappointed on many fronts. Of course, they lost territory to Turkey and, in their view, lost territory to Azerbaijan. And the inclusion of Nagorno-Karabakh, this majority Armenian area in Azerbaijan, was a source of tension during the Soviet period. Regularly the people of Karabakh or the authorities there asked Moscow to be transferred to Soviet Armenia. But again, when it was in Soviet times, the Soviet Union was the state. So this was an internal disagreement, which didn't have any major international implications. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, you end up with Armenia and Azerbaijan becoming two UN member states. And that makes it an international conflict and one which has no external restraining power. So quite simply, in the absence of Soviet power, they slug it out for the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh in the early 1990s. 30,000 people are killed in what is a very, very bitter and bloody conflict. A million people are displaced. Both the majority of them are Azerbaijanis, but there's a substantial minority of Armenians. Both simply go either direction. Armenians living in Azerbaijan flee to Armenia and vice versa. And the Azerbaijani population in Nagorno-Karabakh, they constituted about a quarter of the population. They flee, and Armenia occupies the whole of Nagorno-Karabakh plus the seven adjoining territories, which were never contested and were always considered to be part of Azerbaijan. They use that as a buffer zone to protect from another attack from Azerbaijan. And there the conflict kind of fossilized. It was frozen for 26 years. The ceasefire was in 1994. It was a humiliating defeat for Azerbaijan, which was, a new member of the international community. For the Armenians, it was the end of a, a terrible period in their history, you know, going back centuries, when they had been always, we'll say, victimized by their neighbors, certainly in their view, and again, there's a lot of objective truth to that. And this was their first military victory, their first political victory, and they were determined to hold on to it at all costs, so much so that they displayed a great degree of inflexibility over the last 26 years in entering into any serious negotiations about at least giving back the territories around Nagorno-Karabakh. And the thing is, even though the conflict was frozen, the dynamics were not. Azerbaijan during that period managed to harness a huge amount of oil wealth in the Caspian Sea. Its military budget for several years was much larger than Armenia's national budget in total. And Armenia was almost holding on to this notion that it could retain the status quo without any cost. And whereas Armenia was happy with the status quo, Azerbaijan had this burning sense that a second round was necessary to redress the humiliation of the 1990s, and increasingly had the military wherewithal to implement that. And then, of course, in recent times, Turkey enters the picture by giving full-throated support to Azerbaijan. And that kind of upsets, again, the delicate balance that was there. And it gives Azerbaijan the confidence in September of this year to launch a full-scale attack. So this is a straightforward conflict, in essence, between, or at least it was, it's rapidly changing now, between self-determination, which is what the Armenians were stressing, that they had a right, the people of Nagorno-Karabakh, or certainly the majority there, which were Armenian, had a right to self-determination, should never have been in Soviet Azerbaijan, therefore should never have been in independent Azerbaijan, and should be either independent, which is what they were stating they were in favor of, or unified with Armenia. And Azerbaijan's position, which was one of territorial integrity, that their borders were should be internationally respected. There was great frustration in Azerbaijan that the international community did not enforce their claims to the territories which were internationally given to them after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that was the essence of the conflict, and still remains so today in large part.
Okay, before we come back to the flare-up in September, Donika, I mean, you've traveled regularly to the region. What was life like in Nagorno-Karabakh since 1994?
Well, it was, like many post-Soviet regions, relatively poor. And, you know, Karabakh is a mountainous region. It's not particularly full of natural resources. Agriculture would be a major feature of the economy. And when I first visited, which is now over a dozen years ago, I visited Georgia first over 20 years ago. That was my first kind of posting in the post-Soviet space. Armenia a year later, and then in Azerbaijan. But Nagorno-Karabakh a little bit after that. I think 2008 was the first year I visited Nagorno-Karabakh. And what I found then was a very tightly knit community of people, ruggedly prepared for battle. But at the same time, because of that, it was very vibrant. The politics there was competitive without being vitriolic, simply because, and this was put to me many times when I was arguing about, the opposition parties in Nagorno-Karabakh, and they seemed to be rather tame. And they were saying, well, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, and I guess recent events have illustrated this point very well, at the end of the day, we can only see our other people with different points of view from us in Karabakh, we can only see them as opponents, but the real enemy is Azerbaijan. And therefore there was this feeling that they couldn't be too divided among themselves in Nagorno-Karabakh because of this constant fear of attack, that Azerbaijan would someday come back and try and reclaim the territory. So politics was, I went there primarily to study political parties and elections. And I interviewed most of the major figures there, presidents over different periods, prime ministers, foreign ministers, civil society leaders, and what I found, as I said, was a very vibrant civil society, one that was of course very connected to Armenia, very proud of its Armenian heritage, and very monoethnic. I mean, as I said before, the war in the 1990s, about a quarter of the population were Azerbaijani. They were no longer living there. So it was a completely Armenian society and Armenian speaking. So and the last election that I observed intimately was in 2012. And that was a very competitive election. The incumbent was almost dislodged by a very spirited campaign by a veteran who had fought in the 1990s. And they've had their most recent election in 2020, just earlier this year, as a result of the COVID crisis. It didn't go, of course, smoothly. And that's the reason I didn't go myself to observe the election on this occasion. And one of the candidates actually that made it to the second round, it's a two ballot system, was Massey Ismail-Yan, who actually visited our Conflict Institute in DCU in 2012 as part of a conference that we organized on protracted conflicts in the post-Soviet space. And indeed, one of the other people that was there, Mikhail Zolyan, is now a member of parliament in Armenia, who is having to deal with this major conflagration that has taken place. But since I went there, I've of course tried to make as many connections as possible with the region, and not only, I mean, with similar regions as well, like Abkhazia, Transnistria, and South Ossetia, because of their isolation and because of the fact that they're considered to be conflict zones, there's a very notable lack of engagement with these regions, and they're really thirsty for interaction with the outside world. And that's something that I think at DCU we've tried to facilitate over the years.
You mentioned in your introductory comments, Donika, that Armenia didn't really see any need to move away from the status quo. They were content not only with having the contested region, but a buffer zone around it. But were there attempts over the years to try and broker a more sustainable and lasting settlement?
There were. There was, and there still is, in theory, the OSCE Minsk group. And there are three co-chairs of this Minsk group, and they are the United States, Russia, and France. And it says something about the dysfunctionality of this particular group that the European Union would be, of course, the obvious third party in that group, not France. And the European Union, on more than one occasion, asked France, could they substitute France in that group? And France said no. And France saw it as a matter of prestige that they were part of the group. The format was never popular with Azerbaijan for a number of reasons. One was that they considered it to be ineffective, but they thought that was deliberately so because they believe in the power, which I think has been largely now shown to be inflated, of the Armenian diaspora. And the Armenian diaspora is strong in the United States, in France, in Russia, and they considered that to be a factor in the lack of willingness of the OSCE to take a very proactive approach in resolving the conflict. But the reality is that, you know, the OSCE is a forum for discussion. It doesn't have powers of implementation, and it can't really go beyond what Armenia and Azerbaijan can themselves agree upon. And that really was the problem, that you had this very weak international organization overseeing a conflict which, you know, the side that could actually give, in this case Armenia, was unwilling to enter into serious negotiations. Not without cause, of course. I mean, Levon Terpetrossian, who was the prime minister, or rather the president of Armenia in the 1990s, lost power because he entertained or flirted with compromise on the issue of Karabakh. And he was replaced by two prime ministers in Armenia, both of whom were from Nagorno-Karabakh. And in that sense, could be relied upon not to, to compromise too far. And that was one reason why, in a way, the OSCE initiative didn't work. But there were other factors as well. And as I said, it was quite obvious that after a while, Azerbaijan was going to essentially see war as the only option of pursuing this. And that's essentially what happened in the end.
I can see there that the pressures there were towards potential military flare-up right throughout the last period. Was there any particular reasons why September this year was the time it all erupted rather than earlier or sometime into the future?
Well, because the agreement, if we can call it that, it's a 9-point ceasefire plan, really, that's been signed last week. Because that was conducted behind closed doors, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about how this conflict started and, of course, how it has ended, or at least the military part of it's ended, because the conflict, of course, remains intact. And you know, there are certainly some factors which we cannot deny. And one of it is the more stridently pro-Azerbaijan stance of Turkey. That's certainly one. And there was a flare-up in July, which led to mass protests in Baku, kind of a pro-war protest as such, which was spontaneous, which is unusual in Azerbaijan, because Azerbaijan is, at the end of the day, a dictatorship. A hereditary one at that, the incumbent having inherited power from his father. And but after that, Turkey engaged in joint military exercises with Azerbaijan, and this was a, you know, a very strong demonstration of support. And you have to bear in mind the numbers here as well. I mean, you know, Armenia and Karabakh combined would have a population of about 3 million people. Azerbaijan would have about 10 million. Turkey would have about 80 million. So, you know, Armenia is, you know, already, you know, challenged in terms of the resources it can employ in any conflict. And just to go back to the earlier thing about what moves were made to resolve this conflict. I mean, I think there'll be some soul searching within the Armenian political and military elite about why they were so confident that they could repel an Azerbaijani military attack. I mean, I've been in Yerevan many times and I've interviewed those same elites, and they always were confident that if an event there was an attack, they had the resources, the military wherewithal. And there was even talk of, you know, making a foray into Georgia and cutting the pipeline that supplied Azerbaijan oil to Turkey and onto Europe. And none of that materialized, as it turned out. I mean, Azerbaijan, and with Turkish assistance, there's no question, you know, was much better prepared for this. And therefore, I think what we can say is that this was a war that was going to happen. The circumstances were there. Why September over August or October? It's still quite unclear. And as I said, there are many conspiracy theories. There's even one theory that, you know, Aliyev would probably have had to have approached Putin at least indirectly to get a signal from him about whether they would intervene on the side of Armenia. You have to remember that Armenia is a member of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. It's a member of essentially Russia's version of NATO. And Russia is kind of duty bound to come to the assistance of Armenia if it's attacked. But Russia was sending signals to Armenia during the summer and before, saying that commitment is to the territory of Armenia. And Nagorno-Karabakh is not on the internationally recognized territory of Armenia. It's in the internationally recognized territory of Azerbaijan. And the signal there was that, you know, if you get involved in a major conflict in Azerbaijan or in Nagorno-Karabakh, we won't be coming to rescue you. And that signal doesn't seem to have been received in Armenia. And again, that's a question that the political elite will have to answer themselves. The other important ingredient in the mix, which cannot be ignored, is the personality of Nikol Pashinyan, who is the prime minister of Armenia. They switched to a prime ministerial system from a presidential system just 2 years ago. And he is the first democratic leader, undisputably democratic leader, that Armenia has had for, I guess you could even say, since the Soviet Union collapsed. And he badly mishandled the situation in Karabakh. I mean, whereas his predecessors were from Karabakh, they were much more pragmatic in how they dealt with Azerbaijan and didn't, you know, they didn't cause any symbolic offense, unnecessary, certainly symbolic offenses to Azerbaijan, while not being willing to move, of course, on the fundamental issues of territory. Whereas Pashinyan, for example, you know, was making statements, public statements, saying that Karabakh is Armenia. And of course, that when he said that's been quoted many times by the Azerbaijani political elite, that they said, well, look, there's no talking with this new political elite. They actually were a little bit enthusiastic about Pashinyan when he came to power, thinking that he might be more easier to negotiate with. But actually, he proved to be quite a populist, and in a way, that also fed into this momentum towards conflict. That, you know, the Azerbaijani elite didn't see any way in which they could gain any compromises from the Armenians, and as I said, their military prowess was growing every day. The one other factor as well, just to contextualize this for listeners, that's important to bear in mind for Armenians, is the shadow of 1915. I alluded to it briefly before, but you know what Armenians call the genocide. Of course, this is contested by Turkey, very very, you know, vociferously contested by Turkey. They see it as a very unfortunate mass killing of Armenians during World War I, when, you know, mass killings were the norm throughout much of the world. But for Armenians, this was a targeted attack on their nation in much the same way that the Jews were targeted during World War II. And they are ultra sensitive to any notion that the Turks may be organizing against them. And it makes them perhaps irrational in appraising their real interests. So, the idea of handing back territory to Azerbaijan, which is considered to be, you know, Turkic, if not Turkey, and indeed that's emphasized as well by the leaders of Azerbaijan and Turkey. They often come up with the statement of being one people and two states. So the notion that, you know, Azerbaijan could be trusted with territory given back with Armenians living on it was for an Armenian leader inconceivable. And in a sense, you know, Pashinyan's mistake was, I guess, just not being diplomatic about expressing an unwillingness to compromise, being almost euphoric, being confrontational. And it's no coincidence that Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, you know, in his speech, in his kind of speech, which was given in the early hours of the morning to the people of Azerbaijan, welcoming the victory, it was almost like some kind of ego man-to-man competition where he was saying, you know, Pashinyan, you came to Shusha, which is the is a major town in Karabakh. You came to Shusha dancing and you were saying, you know, how Karabakh is Armenia, you know, and you were saying, and we offered you autonomy for Karabakh. And he said, well, that's off the table now, he says. Who's, you know, who's laughing now? You know, you could see that he'd been rattled, you know, and of course that was representing a much larger section of opinion in Azerbaijan, that they'd been rattled by this kind of unnecessarily euphoric or confrontational attitude of Pashinyan. And that's not to say, of course, that was, you know, the only factor. But as I said, there were lots of underlying factors. But certainly the political elite in Armenia will be answering, I guess, and they are answering, Parliament met today, a lot of questions about why they didn't try to negotiate earlier for something, because certainly they could have negotiated a much better deal than now they've been forced into as a result of defeats on the battlefield.
You mentioned, Donika, that Putin signaled to Armenia that this was going to be his position, but they simply didn't hear him. So in addition to their own exaggeration of their own potential military strength, they miscalculated there. Was that a shift in Russian Federation position on Putin's side? And if so, why?
There's no secret that Putin was not happy with Pashinyan, because to him, Pashinyan was kind of like a color revolutionary. What they saw happening in 2018 was a velvet revolution. So for those who were, you know, in favor of this kind of phenomenon, that this was great. And it was very warmly welcomed in the European Union, for example, and indeed in Western countries generally. And that was the reason why it wasn't particularly popular with Putin. I mean, the idea of, you know, a relatively normal post-Soviet, semi-authoritarian, you know, flawed democratic entity like Armenia becoming more democratic is kind of sends a worrying signal to people in Russia. And that's why, of course, Russia reacted in the way that it did, or certainly Putin did, when he saw similar types of events, color revolutions in Georgia and in Ukraine and in other countries in the mid-2000s. So he was never, I mean, you know, appearances were kept up. And of course, there are state interests at play between Armenia and Russia, which cannot be ignored. I mean, the Russians have a military base in Gumri, Armenia's second largest city. And as I said, Armenia is a member of the CSTO kind of security alliance. But in terms of personality, Putin didn't like Pashinyan. And certainly, I don't think he's unhappy that Pashinyan is in such a state of discomfort now. And I think the Kremlin has played its hand superbly in this conflict. I mean, they didn't commit or lose any military during this war. And yet the settlement means that for the first time, they get troops both in Armenia and in Azerbaijan, and indeed in Nagorno-Karabakh itself, and therefore is able to exercise leverage on both. I mean, for Azerbaijan, they were always proud to a certain extent that they were a country where Russian troops, you know, peacekeepers had not been deployed in the kind of disputed areas, as they had been in Abkhazia, in South Ossetia, in Transnistria. And to them, it was kind of a symbol of their independence that they could keep the Russians out. And here you have a situation, as I said, where, you know, the Russians didn't commit any troops to the conflict. The Armenians, of course, feel betrayed. But there's also a strong element in Armenia, which is quite pro-Russian, and argue that the conflict has demonstrated that Pashinyan's flirtation with the West and his rhetoric of democracy has proven to be extraordinarily hollow, that when push came to shove, Russia was the only power with the ability and the willingness to intervene, even at a late stage, to hold off what would have been an even worse scenario. Because without Russia intervening, what would have happened? I mean, the whole of Nagorno-Karabakh undoubtedly would have been taken within a few more days. And the Russians intervened at a point where, you know, they more or less put a gun to the head of Pashinyan and said, sign this or, you know, the whole of Karabakh will go. I mean, Pashinyan has said from the outset, you know, what he signed wasn't an agreement. It was a joint statement with his signature on it, but he didn't agree to the contents of it. He just knew that he had no alternative because militarily they were exhausted. And he's been very defensive about, you know, criticisms of him of being a traitor, because that's what many are calling him right now. And he's saying, you know, the people who betrayed Nagorno-Karabakh and the people living there are very wide-ranging. He included his predecessors. He included people who didn't go to Karabakh to fight. And he said that the blame has to be shed very, very broadly. But for Russia, it reinforces their role now as the primary, you know, peacekeeper. And I guess we can use that term rather loosely in the post-Soviet space. And they have now a greatly enhanced military presence in the region. But it's important to stress that their presence as peacekeepers, because, you know, we in Ireland, of course, we are involved in UN peacekeeping around the world. You know, this is a very specific type of peacekeeping that the Russians are engaged in. I mean, you know, firstly, it doesn't have a mandate of any international organization. That's an important, because when we think of peacekeepers, normally we think of them having a mandate of the UN or the OSCE or the European Union, for that matter, as exists with the European Union Monitoring Mission, for example, in Georgia. You know, it's purely Russian in its composition. You know, usually peacekeepers are you know, made up of the militaries of different nations. In the case of this, it's purely Russian. And it also goes against the norm that exists in international politics, that peacekeeping in a neighboring country is not something to be recommended. So there's a whole range of kind of things that make this an unusual peacekeeping exercise, not to mention the fact that it was, you know, the whole agreement was conducted in a very rapid and opaque negotiation behind closed doors. Even the president of Armenia said he had no idea that this, ceasefire plan was in gestation, let alone know the contents of it, implying that he probably wouldn't have signed it himself. And that's one of the reasons why Armenia is feeling so traumatized right now, because they had been told, not just during this war, but before that, that, you know, they were in the ascendancy, that they could repel any attack. And even during the war, they were being told that they were going to win. And then suddenly they signed this humiliating capitulation on the basis that there was no alternative. So, you know, there's a strong sense of multiple betrayals here with Armenia, betrayal from Russia, who they thought would come to save them, but also betrayal from their own political and military elite, who had told them that there was nothing to worry about. And one final thing worth mentioning about this peacekeeping presence is that it's for 5 years, and it has to be renewed every 5 years. If one of the parties to the conflict, if Azerbaijan in particular, vetoes its renewal, then it can be stopped. Otherwise, it's renewed automatically every 5 years. So the question is whether Azerbaijan will renew this in 5 years' time, or whether they'll see this as a five-year transition for Armenians simply to evaporate from the territory because they don't want to be governed or don't trust an Azerbaijan government to govern them, or whether we have a potentially kind of open-ended Russian military presence, or a cycle of instability where every 5 years we begin to worry about whether this will be extended or not. It's a very, very unusual type of peacekeeping, and not one that is normal international practice.
Given that sort of humiliation for Armenia at the end of the conflict, Donika, I suppose particularly given the absence of any really significant coverage in Western media, including Ireland, I mean, how bad was the war that Armenia was in the situation by the end?
Oh, it was in a really, really bad state. And we don't even know now how many people died. I saw a statement from the Ministry of Health in Armenia saying that they were talking in the region of 2,400 bodies. Because some have obviously been identified, some are being swapped still with the Azerbaijanis. And the Azerbaijanis did, by the way, release yet their military casualties, which suggests that they are multiples of what the Armenians lost, because the Armenians were defending mountainous positions and were considered to have a strategic advantage in that respect. They didn't have a technological advantage, that was clear, that was with Azerbaijan, but they had a strategic advantage of being in the mountains. So it's reckoned that the attacking force would be losing at a ratio of 2 to 3 to 1. And therefore, you know, we could be talking of casualties, you know, in the region of 10,000 altogether, which is remarkable when you think it was a 6-week war. Vladimir Putin, when he made a statement in the latter stages of the conflict, no, actually it was in the middle of the conflict, more or less, he said that in 10 years in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union lost 10,000 troops in a decade. In a decade, they lost 10,000 troops. And that was a traumatic experience for the Soviet Union. But like in 6 weeks, Putin's statistic then was, he was talking after a month. After a month of conflict, he was saying 5,000 people more or less had died, and it may have been more. And I, as I said, I think it may be more, where the trauma is so difficult to describe. I mean, I know people living in Nagorno-Karabakh, they've left their homes, they've fled. And I see reports of people burning their houses. They're taking everything, the windows, the toilets, everything, and burning the houses so there's nothing left behind. I've seen people who have, I know this is impossible to imagine, but they have dug up the graves of their family and friends because they don't want to leave them in a territory which is going to be controlled by Azerbaijan. They fear that the graves would be desecrated and whatnot. Now, I mean, from an Azerbaijani perspective, they would say that you're getting your just desserts. This is what happened to our people 30 years ago, and they had to leave more rapidly and with much less comfort. Most of the Armenians who have left Karabakh have left by car or by bus, whereas people 30 years ago were leaving often by foot through mountainous terrain. So, and I think that underlines another aspect of this problem, that this generation is suffering for the mistakes of the last generation, because the conflict was not resolved, it was frozen. And it's no coincidence that the children of those who fought in the 90s are those who died during this conflict. I mean, it was heartbreaking to see the names of the soldiers and the ages of the soldiers when they were giving these releases. I mean, they were all born about 2001, 2002. They were like 18, 19, 20 years of age. I mean, I've given lectures at the universities in Yerevan, in Baku, in Karabakh. I've met students of these ages. It's just, and of course we teach students of these ages at DCU, undergraduate students. It's impossible to imagine them under such circumstances, under such intense circumstances. And both Armenia and Azerbaijan have conscript armies. And indeed the army in Karabakh was a conscript army. So these are really ordinary people, sometimes with minimal military training. Well, I mean, minimal in the sense that they're not professional soldiers. I mean, conscription involves a year or two in the army, but these are often done in a very amateur fashion, and often then time passes between then and when they're called to military service. But this was something that happened very rapidly. And I think that's another reason why it's so traumatizing, because they were being sent to their deaths, with the exhortation that Karabakh is Armenian, it's part of our identity, and we will preserve it. And then when somebody loses their son in battle, because invariably they are men and they're boys, really, to a large extent. And then you kind of go, for what? I mean, for this humiliating capitulation, this is why I lost my son. It's extremely hard for people to digest. And I think that's one of the reasons why the protests were so spontaneous in Yerevan. I mean, the parliamentary speaker was beaten up on the street. He was just dragged out of his car and beaten to a pulp. People just, and you could see a lot of the people on the streets were women, middle-aged women, who you probably felt it was their sons who had been dispatched, and dispatched, it seems now in retrospect, on a hopeless mission, because, the Armenian army was woefully underprepared for such a conflagration. And again, that's going to cause a lot of soul searching. So I guess, this is, for Armenians, this is the latest in a long series of traumas they've had historically. With that one victory in the 1990s, which has now been taken from them, in the lifetime, in essentially they've had it for one generation and now it's gone. And even when they had it, I think they always knew that it was very precarious and unsustainable. And I think that's one of the problems now with what we have, is that we have a ceasefire document, but we don't have a peace settlement. This is a 9-point plan about, what will happen in the very short term. But that's what we had in 1994 as well. We had a ceasefire, but we didn't have a peace settlement. And there's a lot of ambiguities in this document. There's no mention, for example, of what the status of Nagorno-Karabakh will be in 5 or 10 years' time. And that's always been at the heart of this conflict. And without addressing that in a way that people can agree to in an inclusive way, the conflict will endure, and perhaps the next generation will find themselves having to face these same issues. And it's complicated by the fact that we have, Russia and Turkey jockeying for position in the region as well. So it's it's unfortunately this agreement, it has silenced the guns, but it's not a clear, sustainable peace by any stretch.
Donegan, do we know yet how many people have remained in Karabakh? I mean, is there any future for an Armenian community there?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, there were 150,000 people there when the conflict broke out at the end of September, which seems now a world away. And I'd say at one stage, first it was the women and children who left. And I was in contact with people from there, and they left very early on when the conflict started, once the Azerbaijani army was getting, you know, within striking distance, because of course they were using very sophisticated technology that could attack from the air, drones, for example. So there was shelling of Stepanakert, the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh, from a very early stage. People were hiding in bunkers, but then eventually, I said, they left. Then of course, you know, other men left, you know, men who were not of military grade, we'll say, or who couldn't contribute. And I, you know, there was one stage, I'd say, by the very end of the war, when there may have been only, you know, 15 or 20,000 people left, the rest having fled. Now, I do hear that some are trickling back now that, you know, there is a ceasefire. We don't know, of course, whether they're trickling back just to collect more of their household goods, or whether they're going back to stay for longer. I mean, some of the regions of Nagorno-Karabakh are now going to be lost for sure. I mean, like an area like Shusha, for example, which is known as Shushi to Armenians. They have the same, of course, differences of what to call things as we have in Ireland with Derry and Londonderry. It's Shusha or Shushi. You can tell where someone's coming from by what they call it. But they've lost that one, for example. That was the second most populated town in Nagorno-Karabakh. So some areas are lost. Some are being protected now by Russian peacekeepers. 2,000 Russian peacekeepers, of course, is not enough, you would think, to control such a territory. But as in South Ossetia, perhaps in 2008, Russia knows that it doesn't have to have a full army there. It just has enough to deter, because, of course, an attack on Russian peacekeepers would bring the full might of the Russian army eventually on the heads of those who attacked it. That's what happened in Georgia in 2008. So that's the signal, of course, that's sent to Azerbaijan. But I don't think we'll see. I mean, that is the big question. I mean, whether there is a future now for Armenians living in the territory of Karabakh. I mean, have they replaced being an Armenian protectorate for being a Russian protectorate? And if so, what does that mean? What does that mean for the political system that existed in Karabakh for a quarter century, the one that I analyzed over the years? You know, I mean, they had their elections, as I said, only this spring. You know, will that continue in some truncated form? You know, how you know, they've lost, as I said, territories. I mean, even on a political level, they don't have the same constituencies. It's all so fluid. It's all happened so quickly. And you kind of alluded to it briefly earlier. One of the amazing things is just how disengaged the West has been from this. I think that, you know, I don't think that how the war progressed was absolutely predictable. I think Azerbaijan, as a relatively small state, would have been waiting to see what kind of reaction there would be from the international community. And they realized that there was going to be none. You know, the America, of course, was distracted with the presidential elections. The European Union was sending out vague expressions of concern. I mean, there hasn't been a single item on Irish radio or television since this agreement has been signed, since the war has come to an end. I mean, it's just remarkable when you think of the amount of people killed, displaced, and some of the terrible things that have happened. We know in Ireland, for example, about the importance of dealing with issues of legacy. I mean, there's been a cycle of impunity in this conflict, you know, dating back to the 90s, which has to be broken. I mean, for sure, war crimes were committed during this last 6 weeks. I mean, there's all sorts of horrible photos and videos circulating, many of which can be verified and have been verified. And it's quite clear that terrible things have happened. And yet the international community, the world at large, really didn't care. I mean, when you compare it to the blanket coverage that was afforded to something like the attack on Vienna. Do you remember the attack on Vienna? It was just about a month ago. I think about 3 or 4 people killed, blanket coverage. Because of course we all, you know, people say, oh, I know somebody in Vienna, I've been to Vienna, or Vienna's in the European Union. And I don't think I've ever felt as much, you know, how we really have a tiered system of humanity in the world, when we can say that thousands of people dying on what is the periphery of Europe really doesn't engage people for a moment. Not worth, as I said, one news item. You know, and well, you think Sorry?
I think they'll be surprised by that, or is it the fact that the European Union fundamentally doesn't see the South Caucasus as European? It doesn't see it as in its backyard. It's they accede to Russians' notion that it's Russia's backyard.
Well, I think that's what they've tacitly accepted and perhaps have done so for many years. But you have to remember that the South Caucasus is part of the European Neighbourhood Programme. You know, these are, and they have been given signals of perhaps not European Union membership, but like, you know, Georgia, for example, neighbouring Georgia, which is, of course, very eager and active in this area, has been told that it will be a member of NATO one day, no deadline given, but one day. Armenia was offered a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union. Georgia accepted and it's been implemented. Armenia, they had exactly the same experience as Ukraine. They accepted it more or less. And then at the last minute under Russian pressure, they withdrew from it and instead veered towards Moscow. And you remember, that, of course, that was the reason why you had the conflagration in Ukraine in 2014. In Armenia, they simply joined the Eurasian Union, the Putin's more or less rival organization to the European Union. So they made their choice in that respect, but they've always had very strong links to the European Union. They consider themselves to be one of the oldest European peoples, if not the oldest. And I think that, again, going back to that feeling now in Armenia, I think that there were those who were more pro-Russia and those who were more pro-European, and some who argued for a multi-vector foreign policy. But one thing that's been demonstrated without any doubt, that when push comes to shove, when everything hits the fan, only Russia counts. The European Union isn't engaged at all. And I guess, you know, when you look at the agreement that's been signed, you know, they didn't even, it seems, consult with the other members of the Minsk group, the United States and France. The European Union certainly wasn't consulted. And I guess they're paying the price for years of disengagement. And they have kind of almost by neglect and by inertia, you know, pushed themselves out of the region. It's not that they've been pushed. They've just, as I said, they've taken their eye off the ball. And as I said, the result is a victory for regionalization over kind of multilateralism. And the international community, as I said, doesn't have really a role here now. It's essentially, we're back to some kind of 19th century spheres of influence and or indeed 20th century for some part. And Russia and Turkey are the key players in the South Caucasus.
Donika, you also write on the Northern Ireland peace process. Is there any prospect of a negotiated settlement that would defend some Armenian interests in Karabakh? Or is really just a question of what Azerbaijan is willing to do at this stage without any broader conflict resolution settlement?
Well, it's interesting that at various points before now, both sides have made reference to the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process in Northern Ireland, but only to, of course, advance their own particular point of view. And of course, that means that they've been cherry picking. So, for example, the Armenians always made reference to the border poll. You know, so they said, oh, there's a lot to be learned from the Good Friday Agreement because ultimately there's a border poll for the disputed area. And of course, our disputed area is Nagorno-Karabakh. We know that a border poll would indicate a majority want to be separate from Azerbaijan. So we think it's a great idea, this Good Friday Agreement and this border poll. And then you go to Azerbaijan and they kind of think, yeah, there's a lot to be learned from the Northern Ireland peace process. And I spoke with people in Baku about it over the years. And they would say, you know, what I like about it is its idea of you know, I'm just trying to think now of what aspect. Oh yes, of Ireland taking away its territorial claim on the disputed area. If only Armenia could follow that example, and just as Ireland did with Articles 2 and 3, if Armenia could take its claim off Nagorno-Karabakh, then everything would be so much better. So yeah, Good Friday Agreement, a lot to learn from that. So, you know, I guess when Ireland was chairing the OSCE in 2012, I mean, they were very careful to give people information about the Good Friday Agreement, because Eamon Gilmore, of course, was our foreign minister at the time, and he was visiting Yerevan and Baku and Tbilisi, and they were, you know, hosting events highlighting what had been done in Ireland. But they were quite clear that they could not be prescriptive. And I always think, you know, in discussions like this, that Leo Tolstoy was onto something in Anna Karenina when he said that, you know, happy families, you know, every happy family is the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own particular way. And you could say the same with conflicts as well. It's very hard to export a blueprint, certainly from Northern Ireland, to the very difficult, different terrain of political terrain of the Caucasus. And you might say that it's also at an earlier stage of development in a way. I mean, the conflict is still at the very ethnic level. There still isn't really a concept of, you know, a civic citizenship. You know, I mean, Ireland and the United Kingdom, which are kind of the guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, both, for all their faults, have a strong sense of you know, civic citizenship that transcends ethnicity. That really doesn't exist in the Caucasus, in any really part of the Caucasus. You know, you're not really considered to be Armenian if you don't speak Armenian, if you don't you know, practice the correct religion and whatnot. And similarly, you know, other parts of the Caucasus have very strong senses of who they are. It was one of actually the points that President Aliyev of Azerbaijan liked to make to an international audience because he felt it would get traction. He would say that, you know, why is it that, you know, when our, you know, our, why is it that Armenians are so monoethnic? You know, I mean, the 99% of the people who live in Armenia are Armenian. It's because they can't tolerate anybody else. And he said that, you know, how would you feel if Armenians traveled to your part of the world? And of course they have, he knew that, of course, being a diaspora. And he said then, you know, they sustain themselves as a local majority in your district. And then they said they wanted autonomy and then independence. You know, that's what we're facing here in Azerbaijan. But to go back to the question of Northern Ireland and conflict resolution models, the other one that had been raised over the years was the Åland Islands between Finland and Sweden. And as you know, I mean, the population of the Åland Islands is majority Swedish. And in 1920, the League of Nations, when this case was submitted to them by Finland and Sweden, they adjudicated in favor of Finland so that the islands came under Finnish jurisdiction. And they have thrived since then. Of course, Finland is a very open, inclusive, democratic society. People in the Åland Islands, they have the Swedish People's Party. They're represented in the Finnish legislature. Everybody's happy. And actually, Finland is the only country in the world outside of Sweden where you see Swedish signs everywhere. All the signs are bilingual to accommodate that small minority. So that was put to people as well in the past at various events. And there was an interesting incident where the president of Nagorno-Karabakh at one meeting said that he was willing to accept such a model. And this caused a gasp of surprise. I mean, everybody was saying, well, look, we seem to have solved the whole, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh problem. The president of Nagorno-Karabakh is saying that he'll go with this. And then he said with a smile, he said, yes, he says, autonomy within Finland, we can accept that. And his point was, is that, you know, Azerbaijan wasn't Finland. You know, Azerbaijan is, as I've said, a hereditary dictatorship. The president is the Ilham Aliyev, is the son of the previous president, Haidar Aliyev. Indeed, the vice president is his wife. You know, they keep it in the family there. And there's no sense that it's going to change anytime soon. So certainly not Finland. Though when I put that point to people in Azerbaijan, they quickly point out that the Armenians are not Swedes either. And again, that underlines the difficulty in exporting conflict resolution models from very different environments.
We've spoken a lot, Donika, about Russia's influence in this context and the absence of the European Union from the recent situation. What about Turkey? How have they emerged geopolitically from the recent conflict?
Oh, they have come out of this very well. I think there's no question there. I mean, they've gained you know, some important leverage and recognition of their role in the conflict at very little cost to themselves, since it did not commit any troops to the ground. Their place is recognized. There will be a kind of a monitoring center in the area. It's not quite clear where this ceasefire monitoring center will be, but Turkey will be part of it. Aliyev did hint that there might be Turkish peacekeeping troops in working also in Karabakh along with the Russians, but that was quickly dismissed. It seemed to be in kite flying, really. It was dismissed by the Russians. It doesn't seem that it will happen, but they will have some presence in this center that will monitor the ceasefire. They will also importantly get a transport link between their exclave, which is Nakhchivan, which is squeezed between Turkey and Armenia. And because of this conflict, there was no way it could connect by road with the rest of Azerbaijan. Now they're going to get a road which Armenia, humiliatingly, will have to allow this road to connect Nakhchivan to the rest of Azerbaijan. It will go through Armenian territory, and that will allow Turkey to have uninterrupted and unfettered access from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea and onto Central Asia. It will confirm its place as an energy hub at the gates of Europe. So it's a very important, even though Turkey is not mentioned explicitly in the agreement, it really comes out of this much stronger. There is, of course, an irony in all of this, is that I couldn't help but notice on the Twitter feed of the Turkish Ministry for Foreign Affairs yesterday, Turkey congratulating the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus on Republic Day. And of course, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus is an unrecognized state, just like Nagorno-Karabakh was or is, and except that the patron is Turkey. And of course, so Turkey on the one hand is saying we're shocked, horrified by this notion of separatism and unrecognized states existing on the territory of Azerbaijan. But of course, they sponsor exactly the same type of setup in Cyprus. So, you know, I think the lesson there is that the patron is very important for these unrecognized states. If you look at like Abkhazia and Transnistria and South Ossetia, they're quite secure because Russia is their patron. And indeed, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus is also secure so long as Turkey is willing to support it. Of course, as long as people in Northern Cyprus want it to be supported. But it was not the case. Armenia could not act as an effective patron for Nagorno-Karabakh. And that was the undoing of that whole arrangement and the future of Karabakh as an independent entity.
Okay, and maybe casting that wider net to the other unrecognized states in the region, which we might come back to another day, is a good way to conclude. Donika, I'd like to thank you very much for your insights. It really gives us a strong sense of your own work over many years in that region, and hopefully it's useful to mark the first of our Conflict Institute podcasts. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.